Hey everyone, welcome back to the Breakpoint Show. It's leap year. Mm-hmm. So we are actually recording on February 29th, which only shows up once every 4 years. So every leap year on this date, I always think of, what if you were born on February 29th? What would your legal birthday be if you were born on February 29th? So it's just something that rattles around in my head.
I think Martin and I would be 10, I think. Which kind of matches up with our mental maturity. So
yeah, I would probably be like 12 or 13, which kind of really fits me. but that brings up a good point. So that's data in my head rallying around. And we're going to talk about data today. We're going to talk about databases. We're going to talk about how we work with data inside of our applications. Maybe if we get to that point, we ramble and go off on tangents and stuff like that. But yeah, so we've got, well, let's Martin and Khalid. So thank you guys for showing up. And we've been talking about also, we've been talking about some changes to the show coming up. And we are, once in a while, we're going to have a guest on. So we do have kind of spaces to the side of me, so we're going to bring on someone to talk about some subject. So something that maybe we're not experts in, that we can bring an expert in and kind of give a little more insight and have a better conversation about something. So if you want to share topics or people that you would like to have on the show, we have lots of connections. We're like Ron Jeremy, or not Ron Jeremy.
Oh, geez.
No, that's the bad. Who's from Anchorman? He goes, we're really important people. So, but we know important people. So that's the one good thing about the three of us, is we're not really important people, but we know important people. So let's get into it. I'm looking over at, Martin and I were in the same building. We were in the same city last week. We were in Montreal, Quebec, Canada.
We have shared breakfast poutine even.
And we had the most amazing breakfast. We had breakfast poutines or poutine. And it is the ultimate hangover. Not that either one of us had hangovers, but it would be a good hangover breakfast if you were hungover.
My stomach that is used to European food was just screaming at that point, but it was really good.
Yeah, it had the most amazing cheese curds and gravy and the steak fries, and it had bacon, so really like crispy cooked bacon, and then an egg. I had a fried egg on top, and man, that thing held. I didn't even have to eat lunch, even though there was a sit down like 3 or 4 course meal for lunch at Comfu. So Comfu is really good for the foodies out there. So
cool.
Exactly.
Yeah. Sorry, so, I took everything. Martin, what was your take on Kung Fu? I really enjoyed the show.
Same thing. The breakfast poutine was amazing. I concur. That's absolutely without discussion. But also the conference is really nice because it's one of those hidden gems, I would almost say. It's known and it's popular, but it's also small enough to feel like a tight-knit group of people all joining together around different technologies, which is the other thing that I really like. Is that there's people from the .NET community, from PHP community, from Java, from data, Python, all of those things.
Yeah, PHP.
And it's really nice to be able to strike up random conversations with people doing something else and gain insights from them.
But
I think I mentioned this to, yeah. I think I mentioned this to Khalid, but I even had chats around AI with the barista who was serving coffee there. So it's a really cool conference.
Yeah, it was. And I will say, if you know French, it's pretty much everything. Everyone speaks in French in Quebec. It's the primary language. But it was a great place. So I tried to throw around a few French phrases and words. Nothing to get my face slapped, because there's a few phrases I know in French that I could get my face slapped and stuff like that. But yeah. So data. I'm curious, what was the first true database that each one of us worked with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess for me professionally, I was first employed in a .NET shop. So SQL Server, like the first kind of versions of SQL Server, were probably like my first professional databases. I would say my first actual database is probably Microsoft Access. That one is probably still a staple today in a lot of businesses. So Access and SQL Server were probably one of my first database experiences. So, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I was, ever since we started discussing this show and I started thinking about what was my first database, I think my first database was essentially a for each or a for loop in Perl over a CSV file that had some query semantics with what we built on top of that. But looking back, I would not call that a real database. So I think the first real database is probably going to be MySQL version 1 or 2 somewhere, but mm-hmm. also from Perl.
Yeah. So I think you have to apply the ACID rule to database. Yeah. So the first database that had any adherence to the ACID theorem rule, whatever mm-hmm. ACID would be. So yeah. So when I got out of college, I didn't go the Microsoft development. I actually did Borland. I did Borland back in the 80s. That's what I learned in high school on Apple IIcs. If anyone remembers those old Apple IIs, it was like a couple versions past the iconic Apple IIs. And we had Turbo Pascal. And then in college, we used Turbo Pascal for the entry language. And then we moved on to C and C++. And but my first database was DBase coming out of college, which was kind of a flat file. I don't know if it adhered to ACID or not, but that was the first kind of database. And to be honest, I think that was it was a NoSQL database, because mm-hmm. you had basically a file for every data type or table. So that was kind of interesting. So I guess I was way ahead of everything with NoSQL and object databases. So
yeah, I know I joined some organizations that were still kind of on like mainframe technologies. So like DB2, IBM's DB2 was popular. Just batch jobs that run at night and kind of true up everything. It's kind of amazing where we've come with databases, from things that store large amounts of data but are basically slow and you can't really introspect, to now being able to process billions of files within seconds, right? So it's kind of amazing.
Yep. I did, actually, when I first came out of college, I did Power Builder, which was just a development environment where you dragged and dropped, and then Sybase. That was the other database, SQL database. That mm-hmm. and then we switched over to SQL Server. The first, actually, we were working with Beta a beta version of SQL Server in 95, 96.
Wow. So it's the best idea, right? Build your production apps on an alpha or beta.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Database. Yeah.
You know, it kind of brings up an interesting point, though, right? Like when we look back at our first databases, they were all kind of like either on this enterprise style hardware that like sat in a room that you couldn't touch. It was like air gap secured, everything. And then we moved to self-hosted databases like MySQL, SQL Server. But now we're kind of in the era of this like planet scale distributed database, like cloud database environment. How do you folks feel about that kind of transition? Do you still want control over your databases, or do you see it just kind of as a dumping ground for information?
I will say I see it as a dumping ground for information. So I don't care where it runs or how it runs or whatever. Like I use Microsoft's Azure SQL database, for example, and that runs somewhere in a data center, I think in West Europe, in Amsterdam. And that's mm-hmm. great. I have options to configure it to do replication to other regions in the world, which is fairly fast. It's not real time. There's other databases for that, but it's fairly fast. It still looks and feels like a SQL Server database from how I use it and consume it in my .NET applications. But the really interesting thing is that I don't have to take care about making sure that I run daily, night, or nightly backups or whatever. It's there. I can configure it. I can create a user. I can start pushing data into it. And if I need to roll back to a certain version from 5 minutes and 20 seconds ago, I can just do that from the portal. So I don't even have to think about that. And I think that servicing aspect is probably even more interesting than the fact that we can run global databases and yeah. planet scale databases.
Yep. And I'll put a twist. I think that, we need to be really, really diligent about data, because as we've seen with AI and what kind of feeds into AI, it's data. And data is really, really important. So I like the quote, data is the oil of today, where mm-hmm. oil was kind of the most important commodity in the world, say like 50, 60 years ago. I think data is really important today. So as one who has lived through many data hacks and issues with databases, like raise your hand if you have lost production databases and took days to figure out how to get that data back, or just lost it entirely. And
I was super lucky that our IT guys actually had two hourly backups, I think, and that the backup just finished at the time that I dropped the customer table or something in production. So they were able to restore, and I think we lost maybe 2 minutes of data,
I remember losing a database, and we had a backup from like 2 days before. So all of us developers spent like 3 days taking text logs and figuring out how to take those text logs from the last 2 days and bring them into the database and everything. So, data is important. Data is important. So we've been talking about data, and we're developers. So the logical connection would be, how in the heck do we use data in our applications? And so I'm just going to throw it to one of you guys. I mean, we have seen this progression of databases over the years, but we've also seen this evolution of how we work and access and retrieve and save data in our applications also.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess what you're hinting at here is like, Do you use an object relational mapper or do you not use an object relational mapper?
No. Right? This is the moment where Chris finally gets to bring up stored procedures.
Everybody drink now. No, it's interesting, right? Like stored procedures, I think like early in my career were kind of the go-to way to squeeze out performance and access data and kind of create a security model for better or worse, right? Like stored procedures were it. And then developers needed to iterate faster. And that's kind of when object relational mappers became a thing. Also, developers are bad at writing SQL in code without introducing a lot of SQL injection attacks. We still, oddly, still have SQL injection attacks even today. So it seems like we haven't learned that lesson even from going on two decades at this point. And I'm curious how that will actually shape up once AI starts recommending, snippets of code that may potentially have SQL injection attacks in them. But for me personally, I've always kind of liked object relational mappers. I know a lot of people maybe don't like them because maybe there's performance overhead or potential mismatch between objects and the database. But I think ORMs really are helpful, especially when you're trying to quickly get to a solution and ship something that people can look at, give feedback on, and iterate on quickly. But I'm also a big fan of SQL as well. So my philosophy has always been start with object relational mappers, iterate quickly, and then start to optimize potentially towards SQL or even Chris's beloved stored procs.
So. Well, can I make a statement, and this will be funny and make you think, So are serverless functions kind of like are like what Azure has Azure functions and AWS has Lambdas?
Yeah.
Were stored procedures yesterday's serverless functions?
I've seen some pretty gnarly stored procedures, so I'm gonna
think
say
about
no.
that. So well, I'm gonna throw that out because I think stored like not retreat not stored procedures to get data, but stored procedures to insert or update data. I think those were yesterday's serverless functions that everyone loves today. So
yeah.
So Khalid, you've seen pretty gnarly stored procedures. I have seen pretty gnarly microservices. So maybe Chris is onto something.
See? I mean,
maybe we're all just bad at software development. Maybe that's that the theme here.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, yeah, Martin, let's get your take on everything.
It's an interesting question and proposition, and I have no real idea what to think of it yet. I will say, though, that stored procedures were kind of interesting back in the days when I was doing direct, like from code, not using ORMs and so on, just using direct SQL in application codes, because resources were much more expensive to get, like server resources, server hardware, etc. would be more expensive. And at least here in Europe, in most countries, you will never build applications where your application needs to scale out to multiple machines. And you would go for redundancy, but you would probably not go for a cluster just to cope with traffic, depending on what you're building, of course. But the general line of business application would not need that. And I know the team that I've worked in, one of the architects back then, was very fond of trying to use as much of the resources from the database server as possible, which meant that he was a big fan of pushing some of the logic of the application and so on into stored procedures, and in a way bring a part of the application into the database and just run it on the database hardware instead of the web server hardware.
Yeah.
Which was an interesting take. I'm I don't think I'm a real fan of it, but it was an interesting take, and I guess it kind of relates to that.
I totally agree with that take. Is evenly distribute your application if possible. So the cool kids, I it's amazing. I listen to a lot of JavaScript podcasts, mm-hmm. and the chatter of like currently is all about it's server-based components, like React server-based components. And I'm like, what? And they're like, oh, this new thing. And oh, it's so amazing. Like you don't have to do all this stuff with APIs and we just push everything to the server. It's like, they think they're discovering this new thing. It's like, that's how we used to do pretty much all of web development. Was we would just call a web server and it would give us back HTML that we needed for the front end. So there's this pendulum that swings back and forth, and it's interesting. I think it's kind of swinging back towards the server side, just because like I've said it in the past, big pipes. Now that we have really fast internet connections on everything from our homes to our mobile devices, do we need to push all that logic to the browser, to the front end, to the mobile application? Or can we have it evenly distributed from the front to the back?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting in the case of databases and just working with databases in regards to your question, it's like the sooner you can do work and do less work, the better. So like when it pertains to databases, if everyone that's visiting your site is executing a particular query over and over again, but it's literally the same query with no new inputs or no anything, it probably makes sense to run that query once and cache it so that everyone benefits from it. And with React, like we're getting into React here, but it kind of relates with React server components, it makes sense to process a component once so that no matter if 1 or 1,000 users visit your site, they're having the same exact experience. And frankly, in a world where everything is on fire at this point, ecologically, and wasting energy on every single client to essentially have to do the same work does not make a lot of sense. So kind of databases, in my mind, were one of the first tools that developers had to kind of like do work once, but share the benefits across the board to all users and all stakeholders when using the application. So it is interesting to see the pendulum swing back towards, okay, let's plan things out. Let's do work intelligently rather than just being wasteful just because we have all these resources that we can kind of burn through. That's kind of been my thought process here over the last kind of year or so, thinking mm-hmm. about these trends. So
yeah.
So speaking of doing work intelligently, I have a question for both of you. what are your feelings about ORMs? Like Entity Framework or Hibernate or Dapper or any of those tools?
So I love them. I love them for data access, to get mm-hmm. data out of a database and put data into a database. But I don't like to push those data models, those entity data models, all the way through my application. One is it makes your application really rigid. Mm-hmm. Like you basically locking your application to the shape and the schema of your database. which for a lot of people, that's fine because they design the database. But I've worked at bigger companies or companies that had really good database developers that developed the database not to make the application easy, but to make the storage of the data the priority. And mm-hmm. that means that you're going into third degree, like all these different degrees
normalization.
Yeah. So if you have like a database that is what, fourth level normalization, it can be really, really weird
mm-hmm.
to try to bring that schema into your database. So I always say that there should be, and some people call them DTOs, that you should have DTOs and you should use the thinking and the processing behind domain-driven design to bridge that gap between your database and your application data shape and schema.
Yeah.
I think that is a good remark there, because we use our ORMs to bridge the object relational gap with an object relational mapper. But in a sense, your object model that you are storing in the database and retrieving from the database by design in that system is still your data model.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it makes perfect sense to have another layer or another type of objects where you denormalize or bring things together again. That you can pass around in the application and think more of as a domain-based language instead of the data language yeah. that you have with the ORM.
Yeah, I totally agree with that with Martin. Like, I think that's when my relationship with ORMs kind of changed, when I started to realize that ORMs are really a representative of the schema that's in your database. And yep. it's really providing you with a query surface, right? So instead of using SQL, you're using, in our cases, C# or F# to write something that will ultimately be translated into SQL. But the types that are part of Entity Framework are really there as representatives of the schema that exists in the database. They're not meant to be treated like objects. So you really shouldn't have things like methods on them. You really shouldn't have C#y or .NET-y things on these objects. That's kind of where I found people get into trouble using ORMs is yeah. like they've kind of forgotten that golden rule that this thing is only there to represent your database. And it should, in reality, represent it one-to-one. It shouldn't try to add any extra flair. And that's, I think, when people really get in trouble with ORMs is like trying to deviate from the schema that they've kind of built out in the database.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Like I used to have a talk. I should bring it back. It was a database. I was talking about database patterns. And there was one I call the historical data pattern, and it's hard to visualize it, but think of a owner table and a house table, like you own, a person can own a home.
Mm-hmm.
So most people would go, oh, well, I have a house ID, which is the primary key in the house table, and it is stored in a column in the person table. And then I go, well, that's true, but are you only going to own one home in your life? And for most people, it's going to be no. So how do you represent that? So then you have to bring in what in the database world is kind of a system table, or that's what I call it, that connector system table that brings both of those both of those primary keys together. Mm-hmm. And then you have that. But then you throw in another wrench and you go, well, I want to be able to have a historical lookup to say, hey, like, show me all the homes that Khalid has owned up to this point. And then you need in this connector system table, you need begin dates and end dates.
Mm-hmm.
Now those three tables brought together in your database are awesome. They have a purpose. But how do you represent that in your application? Like for most people, they don't care about the old stuff. They just want to know the current home that Khalid owns, so you can show it in your application. So, mm-hmm. but other parts of your application need to have a historical view of Khalid's home ownership. So it's this whole, your application needs to take in facets of your database. And that's why having a good database doesn't lend itself to having a one-to-one relationship in your application.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, like, go ahead, Martin. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think you've given Khalid an idea for a blog post.
Well, I was worried that Chris was triggering Gen Z because they'll likely never be able to afford a house. So maybe he didn't pick the best example given the new kids. But
well, okay, car. Well, substitute house for a car.
The cardboard box. Yeah, as the planet burns. But no, this is kind of a good segue, right? Because you talked about ownership and relationships and stuff like that. In the 2010s, when popular sites like Foursquare and all kind of like the Web 2.0 companies were starting to kind of happen, social media was blowing up. There was a new trend in storing data known as NoSQL. How do you folks remember the NoSQL trend starting? And where do you think it is today in terms of popularity when you look at all the other database options that are out there?
I probably have 1,000 opinions and thoughts on the topic. I think the main one is, I think back then everyone was like, yay, NoSQL, and we have to jump on this. Meanwhile, mm-hmm. the old big relational databases also have caught up. So Postgres, SQL Server, and so on. They all have JSON parsing and navigation functions and everything. So mm-hmm. most of these databases currently give you the best of both worlds, where you can have relational data where some of the columns might be a JSON blob that contains further data that you could consider a document database, but that you can still query efficiently. So I think the hype on document databases may have died down a little bit, mm-hmm. but I do think that it is still being used. And especially if you look at ORMs like Entity Framework, where they actively encourage you to, for some types of data, to not normalize and instead just store a JSON blob in a database column. I think we are moving more towards that world where we get the best of both worlds. One additional thought, and that's yet another tangent, I'm afraid, is that there are very specialized databases as well. So for certain scenarios, I think document databases are probably the way to go, and you shouldn't even be looking at relational. But mm-hmm. the same thing today exists for time series-based databases, for example, where you want to keep metrics or statistics over a certain amount of time. That are really optimized to find data within a specific window, for example. And relational databases, they can do that, but those time scale or time series databases will be optimized for that specific scenario. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of other databases. Interesting one I found this week, just showed up randomly on my Mastodon feed, was a database system that was specific for transaction-related data, financial transactions. So if you want to build your own bank or a credit system or whatever, that database was really tuned for that type of transactions where you have multiple accounts that have ledgers, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, isn't that what blockchain was supposed to be? So
let's not talk blockchain.
Yeah, okay.
Martin, I'm wiring you my life savings. Please store it in your new bank application.
I will do it. I will say this database also had in the README a big banner saying, look, the data format might change while we are still in alpha version, so don't use this in production.
Oh, my God. No, yeah. But it is interesting, like, to think about NoSQL. When the trend started, there was a lot of decisions, right? Like, developers were frustrated about the making the leap between code and data, like the database itself. And maybe developers didn't really like SQL or understand SQL. They were frustrated with the insert speeds because maybe they over-indexed, so performance there was bad. So NoSQL made a lot of decisions early on that kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater. Chris, you had mentioned ACID before. ACID basically ensures that when you write something to a database, it gets saved and you can always find it. But some of these early NoSQL databases said, you know what, maybe that's not that important. MongoDB was notorious for this early on, right? With Foursquare, where they would do something called a two-phase commit, where you would write to the database, but then your application would immediately go query for that document to make sure that it actually got stored in MongoDB. So two-phase commit, go look at it. But in today's modern database landscape, I don't think anyone is doing two-phase commit. What a pain in the butt. So
yeah.
Can you remember, like, Chris, like, what was your first experience there? Like, what did you think? Did you dabble in NoSQL?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first NoSQL database that I actually used and used for some work was RavenDB. So we're all friends with
Oren.
Yeah, he's got two names, Oren and but that was the first one, and I saw there was a special case for, you know, for data that you didn't really care. And I used the idea of, like, Twitter and social media posts as that example, where you just want to dump that data into a place and then come back and retrieve it based on, usually it's based on just one kind of key, which would be the user that posted it, but might not be the best example. But so we used it mostly for just dumping raw data that we could really access very quickly, and we didn't really have need, like, indexes and sorting and order by and stuff like that. We just needed to get it in and get it out really fast.
But yeah.
And so I think we're starting to wind down the show. I know we have probably other things on our list. We had migrations, like EF Core migrations, and I think they're evil, but
Oh my God. Let's save this debate for another episode, because I think we could fill an entire 45 minutes.
I don't want to have a 30-second rant.
I will say though, since we are recording on Leap Day, we could make this episode four times as long.
Yeah, well, let's not do that. But you know what, data, I think at the end we're showing that data is important, and data is really hard. It's a really hard concept because we use data in many different ways. Like, we never even talked about how we use data with, like, reporting and with analytics and with KPIs. And so there's a whole facet right there of we talked about data as in, like, presenting data and saving data from the user, the application, or going through APIs. But an important part is, how do we report on that data? Or today, like, how are we storing data in a way that will allow our AI large language models to use that data effectively to build out those models that AI uses? I have no idea. I'm not really a AI expert, so I don't know like what the best format for data is to be fed into a LLM. But I would assume most databases that we have are probably not the like formatted in a way to drive our AI overlords fuel.
Well, to answer that question, and as we wrap up, it's like maybe homework for our audience is LLMs and machine learning are using a new type of database called vector databases. Typically, data for AI is vectorized, meaning like it's turned into a compact format that can be used to train like data model or train these AI models a little bit more efficiently. But it's really data scientists are kind of at the heart of data processing these days and like trying to figure out these formats. So, it's kind of crazy. The more we think about how much data is being produced by humanity, it's a lot. And I think databases need to evolve to kind of support the influx of this amount of data.
Yeah,
I read a crazy statistic the other day that every minute on YouTube, 500 hours of content is uploaded.
Crazy.
Which is, we're doing our part with the Breakpoint show, so it'll be okay. But yeah, like the future of databases is still kind of evolving because we're evolving and trying to figure out how to best store and retrieve this data. And I think these data models, we kind of hit on all of them, file-based, relational, NoSQL, vectorization, time series, the list just kind of goes on. So there's a lot of options out there.
Martin, kind of end thought from you?
I can only say, and I will say this only once and only today, and the next time will be in 4 years on another leap day, and that is Khalid is right.
Oh, yeah! We did it! Did it!
We have proof. We have documentation on that. So
you're just going to edit that part out anyways.
I am. I'm going to edit the whole thing. So, but this has been an awesome show. Please go down, like the show. But remember, we are going to look at guests and we're always looking for new topics. So if you have ideas for topics, if you have idea for a guest, if you're one of those experts that wants to come on the show, hey, we'd love to have people want to come on the show and talk about something. And I'm going to make a special note. I saw yesterday that JetBrains has a new webinar coming out with Chris Klug, where he talks about ORMs and has his own unique view on ORM. So in the show notes, I'll put a link to that webinar. Are one of you guys hosting that?
That's going to be March 21st. So look for it. The comments on the blog post have already been very spicy and spirited. And I've seen even on social media, people have opinions, which I never imagined developers would have any opinions.
No,
we don't have opinions.
Wow. No, but we'll put that in the show notes to drive some discussion for later in next month. So happy leap year day. Thank you, Khalid. Thanks, Martin. And we will wrap up the show. And thanks, everyone, for tagging along with us and listening to us and tell our tale. So.
All right. Bye, folks.
Bye, everyone.